Hi, everybody. We're going to start our panel now. And I wanted to introduce the idea of the panel and then also to introduce the people who will be speaking. So we organized this panel as part of the theme sessions of the conference, which, and the theme of this conference, as you probably know by now, is Spirituality of the Rising Generation. And so we were trying to organize panels that dealt with issues that were important to people around my age, 20s and 30s-ish. And so one of the principal issues that we thought was important to address was the issue of what makes an issue moral and what the church should be addressing, because a lot of people in their 20s and 30s frequently have emotional or spiritual struggles with the church because of the way that it defines morality. So we wanted to present a panel on things that we think, five moral issues that we think are not normally included in the average discourse about morality in the church, and make an argument for why they should be included in the discourse of morality. So today we have five people who will be speaking about five different topics that we consider to be important moral issues. And the first speaker is Katie Savage. I'll just stand up and introduce them in between so you can keep track of them. But our first speaker is Katie Savage, and she is a grad student in the Environmental Humanities program at the U of U, and she is very interested in environmental issues in general, and particularly issues involving animal rights and rights of different species. And she's going to be talking today about environmentalism and the church's responsibility toward to talking about an environmental ethic.
Thanks, Ash. Ash invited me to be on this program ostensibly to make an argument that we should consider environmentalism as a moral issue. And I was a little perplexed by that. I would like to ask instead what form of morality could draw the lines of moral inclusion so as to exclude all environmental decision-making. Even if we only care about human beings, there's plenty of evidence as the ways we're bludgeoning ourselves, and particularly minorities and members of the third world, through the drought, famine. This is for a very tall person. Drought, famine, and illness caused by climate change and the toxification of our environments. Not to mention the storm we're brewing for future generations, who will face the full brunt of our careless decisions and will likely recall our legacy of overconsumption with bitterness. Even if you don't care about the earth because you only care about heaven, we might talk about the entrenched doctrine of stewardship, whereby God gave us dominion over ecosystems and non-human beings according to some form of, you can consider it, legal usufruct, whereby any abuse of our stewardship results in a displeased deity. There are many ways by which our treatment of the environment must enter our moral deliberations, no matter how narrowly we draw the circle of moral consideration, any one of which is sufficient to demand that it form a part of our religious discourse. However, of more interest to me than whether environmentalism is moral is the question of what environmentalism means as a specifically Mormon morality. As a young environmentalist and animal rights activist and vegetarian growing up in a very conservative Mormon family and community, Mormon ecotheology, such as that presented by Hugh Nibley or George Handley, was all that allowed me to retain my sanity as I maneuvered my way around authority figures that could argue me with for hours about a comma in Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants if they saw I was refraining from the loose meat sandwiches at the ward party. I am deeply grateful for the rigorous and hopeful work that Mormon ecotheologians have done. However, my own attempts to justify my behavior to Mormons by showing how their own doctrine requires an environmental conscience has left me concerned about both the status of environmental doctrine in the church and the ways in which ecotheologians use religious authority to promote their ideas, which are very important and urgent ideas. I want to explore these two points in the context of asking, what are the fair ways for us to treat religious texts when talking about moral issues, and how are we to think of those who become disaffected or leave the church over moral issues such as this? Okay, first, environmentalism within the Mormon doctrine. The church has made no official declaration explicitly dealing with our ecosystems and non-human cohabitants. Instead, we have some interesting scriptures which may or may not be contradicted by other scriptures. We have some statements made by prophets in various contexts. We have an old children's song about not shooting little birds. The scattered quality of these texts is precisely why we need eco-theologians here. They are logically extrapolating conclusions that might otherwise never be made explicit. Of course, these works of eco-theology are not considered doctrine by the church membership, but are judged as more or less convincing based upon the arguments they make, with no a priori claim of importance, which is doubtless as it should be for scholars. Within this gamut of texts, as they stand in relation to the rest of doctrine, there are two characteristics which in combination distinguish a doctrinally consistent Mormon environmental ethic from other religious or secular forms, in my mind. One is the sacralization of matter and bodies, and second is the divinely ordained human exceptionalism. And I'll talk about these briefly and how they interrelate. Although many religions which preach spiritual transcendence, like Mormonism does, treat the body and the material world as impediments to this process, Mormonism is explicit in according a sacred nature to them. We are told that spirit and matter are essentially the same substance, that exalted beings have bodies of flesh and bones, that our own familiar earth is our future celestial kingdom. This is clearly fertile ground for growing an environmental ethic. However, as we accord embodiment to matters of the highest spiritual nature, we also accord the boundedness which we attribute to embodiment to the spiritual realm. This results in a doctrine that is highly species conscious, and perhaps some might argue speciesist. All members of our own species, and no other beings, are God's children, as opposed to merely being God's creations. Many other Christian theologies place human beings on the same creation footing that other beings occupy, and certainly speciesism is rife in most forms of Christianity that I've researched, but in no sect have I witnessed this hierarchy so clearly and consistently asserted than within Mormonism. We are not just God's most important creation, we are the particular larval or embryonic form of the kind of being that God is. We are the God species. That the rhetoric of exaltation focuses on the capacity for divine procreation reveals that this biological term is not merely a metaphor. For many, the environmental and animal rights ethics are born out of the consciousness that we are kin with other beings, sharing the same crib of primordial stew. Rather than asserting the great chain of being with humans at the top, these thinkers posit that all species are equally evolved, filling a diversity of roles on our earth. We therefore have no right to be stingy with our home's resources, but must, as a good family member, learn to share. At variance with this, Mormonism's divinely ordained human exceptionalism promotes at least a hierarchy of two levels. On the bottom are the diverse non-human lives, which we are likely to believe can evolve and change throughout time as species. On the top is the eternally consistent God in embryo Homo sapiens. The evidence of Neanderthals or Homo erectus once existing is unsettling, inasmuch as it troubles this dichotomy more than the existence of modern primates appears to. We can retreat to a literalist interpretation of Adam and Eve as the first humans. We can deny scientific research, or we can try to fathom at what stage between Lucy the Australopithecus and us God started having spirit children as opposed to merely making spirit pets. Although we accord power to the earthly by conceiving of a God with a body, we inevitably accord to God bounds as well that leave the earthly again in a subservient position. Just as mere humans can feel powerful when they are told that God is a man, that phrase has the power to simultaneously strip power from half of those humans who are like God, but not quite. And here I'm talking about the worth and future of females, which remains shrouded in mystery. Perhaps we'll become powerful goddesses if we're worthy, or perhaps plural wives for a new father god who will punish his children for attempting to pray to their mother. It could be the fair and delightsome Anglo-Saxon conception of God that allowed us to so willingly denigrate non-white races as divinely punished for their lack of primordial valor. Similarly, an embodied God, which originally appears to offer so much hope toward an environmental ethic, becomes within the species hierarchy merely one more reason to not need to think as hard about our treatment of the beings who are around us. They have worth to God, apparently, but then we are of more worth than many sparrows. Within this algebra of souls, we can assume that as long as the stewardship ethic simultaneously posits that God cares about his children much more than about his other creations, when faced with a situation in which a human could benefit from harm done to a non-human, we can automatically assume that the ethical answer is in favor of the member of our own species. I'm being critical of what I view as a typical Mormon environmental ethic, but I do wish to reiterate that even if an ethic is anthropocentric, this can surely push individuals, anthropocentric being human-centered, focused on the human species, this ethic can surely push individuals toward behavior that benefits the environment. We are hurting humans everywhere, even humans closest to us, even ourselves, by our addictions to things such as oil consumption, meat consumption. What I'm trying to explain is why it might be that individuals could find the doctrinally consistent Mormon environmental ethic as insufficient to explain their moral intuitions. One example could be, if you are interested in killing a pig-footed bandicoot, Tristan told me to use that animal because he likes it, what would be the arguments against it? Anthropocentrically, it would be wrong for you to kill it if it could hurt a human to do so. That might be immediately say, it's my beloved pet, and it would wound me if you killed it. Or we could say, it's just eventually, perhaps the bandicoot population will now be unable to sustain itself, and the fall of this species will precipitate the destruction of other more useful species, which could, who knows, one day eventually leave humans bereft of an important food source. Of course, this threat appears improbable and difficult to conceive of, particularly when weighed against the immediate use a human could make of a pig-footed bandicoot corpse, which, who knows, could be food or clothing or social status or just the entertainment and family bonding of going hunting together. This anthropocentric argument falls flat for me merely because it feels morally wrong to shove a spear in a pig-footed bandicoot's nape, not because I might be hurting humans, and not even because I feel I'm hurting God, whose property the bandicoot ostensibly is. Rather, it is a violation of the creature itself, the bandicoot, as its own bandicoot property, that I find morally reprehensible. I'm not saying this to suggest that we can somehow live completely without violence. I'm aware of the inescapability of food chains. However, it feels crucial to me that we allow questions of competing interests between species members to remain open to ethical debate and sincere dilemma, rather than allowing doctrinal hierarchies to arbitrarily truncate the discussion. Concerning doctrinal hierarchies, I wish to briefly speak of the nature of eco-theologic thought, which I have read and enjoyed, and once again, I'm grateful for. One commonly quoted utterance is the story about Joseph Smith and the three rattlesnakes. Who in here has heard that story? Anyone? So we have some people who have heard it. In short, he's at Zion's camp. The men find rattlesnakes, are about to kill them, and he asserts, "Let them alone, don't hurt them. How will the serpent ever lose his venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war upon it? Men must become harmless before the brute creation. And when men lose their vicious dispositions and cease to destroy the animal race, the lion and the lamb can dwell together, and the suckling child can play with the serpent in safety." He reports, "The brethren took the serpents carefully on sticks and carried them across the creek. I exhorted the brethren not to kill a serpent, bird, or an animal of any kind during our journey, unless it became necessary in order to preserve ourselves from hunger." Isn't it wonderful? And many people who care about the status of non-human animals, including President Spencer W. Kimball, will quote this experience to convince others to value animal lives. Yet, when actually reading the story in the second volume of The History of the Church, I found my enthusiasm dampened by the paragraph immediately following this, wherein Joseph Smith states, "I had frequently spoken on the subject of how we should treat animals, when on a certain occasion I came up to the brethren who were watching the squirrel in a tree, and to prove to them and to know if they would heed my counsel, I took one of their guns, shot the squirrel, and passed on, leaving the squirrel on the ground. Brother Orson Hyde, who was just behind, picked up the squirrel and said, 'We will cook this, that nothing may be lost.' I perceived that the brethren understood what I did it for, and in their practice gave more heed to my precept than to my example, which was right." Here are two statements written by the head religious authority on the same day, published in the same text. In one paragraph, I'm astounded by Joseph's compassion toward animals, which were almost certainly unanimously despised by all other humans present. Only last stand self-preservation is granted as a legitimate reason for killing an animal. He is prophetic in all the beautiful and impossible connotations of the word, in his vision of a world in which, because humans are kind, non-humans somehow repay their kindness. Within the next paragraph, I have difficulty seeing anything but a petulant boy willing to hurl bullets through a squirrel's skull, not for survival, but simply to make sure that everyone has been listening to him. The squirrel is cooked, so nothing may be lost. We suppose that when it's ingested by humans, as opposed to being eaten by other beings in the region, which could have enjoyed a squirrel carcass, it is proclaimed that nothing is lost, even though an animal has lost its life. how do you read this document fairly? How do you use it fairly as a persuasive tool? Hunebly is stunning in his ability to rally prophetic utterances for the sake of environmental persuasion, but if Brigham Young wrote in the Journal of Discourses, "We should love the earth," this is a quote, "we should love the earth, we should love the works which God has made," which is frequently quoted to persuade us to a benevolent end. Brigham Young wrote in the same Journal of Discourses, "Shall I tell you the law of God in regard to the African race? If the white man who belongs to this chosen seed mixes his blood with the seed of Cain, the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot, which will always be so." This one we do not quote. The question is the same for how we can read scriptures fairly. When the Old Testament tells us to subdue the earth and have dominion over it, and the Doctrine of Covenants tells us that all things on the earth are made for the benefit and the use of man, what will we as conscientious environmentalists do? Probably redefine terms, probably deconstruct phrases. My concern is that Mormon eco-theologians too frequently pick out the scriptures, the stories, the claims that best suit them, assert that these are authoritative statements and therefore must be followed by all obedient Mormons, and then ignore or carefully cover up statements from equally authoritative sources which make them uncomfortable. When I did this in conversations with others, I found that scripture stopped being something I loved and became a tool I used to persuade people to do something good. Prophetic utterances were like old family heirlooms whose rubies might be fake. It'll impress them, but you get nervous if they start looking too closely. Eco-theologians engage in this selective research because they are actively pushing an urgent cause. I admire their urgency, and I understand the bind in which they find themselves. I merely want to ask if it's a fair stance for a theologian to take. I personally believe this is only fair if our behavior is made explicit. If we say, "I ignore these scriptures, and I ignore these statements by prophets, and these are the ones I focus on, and this is the reason why that behavior is justified." However, to do this, an eco-theologian would lose the automatic moral authority their argument retains when the canonical authority they quote is unquestioned. I think this is an issue that is pervasive throughout our really urgent moral yearnings to promote a certain idea, a certain moral idea that we feel deeply. Yes, emphatically yes, we must begin speaking about environmental decisions in our Sunday schools. Mormon doctrine makes it clear that the way we treat other humans via the environment is a moral and religious issue. However, I hope my arguments have shown that we should not suppose that Mormon doctrine automatically and unambiguously provides us with a coherent support for such sentiments as the intrinsic worth of non-humans and ecosystems. The honest frustration experienced by dissatisfied members unwilling to continue their conversation with exclusively anthropocentric arguments should not be arbitrarily truncated in the hope that Mormon doctrine provides a complete and consistent foundation for all experienced moral imperatives.
Now, Will Van Wagenen is going to be speaking to us on war. Will has gotten his master's in divinity from Harvard University, and he served for how many months?
Seven
months on a Christian peacemaking mission in Iraq.
All right, well, thanks to you all for coming out today. I know there's some other interesting presentations going on right now that you could have been going to. But again, just to talk about the subject of what is a moral issue versus what is a political issue. Just growing up in the church over the years, I've noticed that, you know, some things are considered moral issues, and therefore the church will usually take a stand of some sort or get involved in politics in some way. Obviously, abortion, gay marriage, I guess the Equal Rights Amendment a couple decades ago. These are all things that, for whatever reason, got branded as moral issues, and so the church became pretty active. And, you know, strangely enough, there are a couple issues that don't seem to get that moral issue label, and one of those seems to be the use of money. And I guess I've got some strong feelings about that, but I won't talk about it because I know Chris is going to. And the other thing is war. You know, whatever wars are going on, whether it's Vietnam War, the Iraq War, whatever, there's no real official statements. You know, the Vietnam War was pretty strongly supported by Ezra Taft Benson, but there was never this official church declaration. one way or the other. It seemed like kind of just this, you know, there wasn't anything real specific about it. And then same with the Iraq War. You know, President Hinckley kind of didn't really, you know, say real strong words one way or the other when he spoke in conference a few years ago. And that's the thing that I find really strange, because, you know, if you just look in the scriptures, there's plenty of guidance about war. That's a really common topic. And, you know, Josh Madsen and his father Ron gave a nice presentation earlier today that focused a lot on Doctrine and Covenants 98, which has a lot to say about war. But just to point out a couple scriptures, you know, that I, you know, came across recently, had obviously, you know, read before, but then read again. And this is from Mormon. And this is a time when, you know, right before the Nephites are basically wiped out and become extinct by the Lamanites. But this is something that that Mormon said. It says, "And it is impossible for the tongue to describe or for a man to write a perfect description of the horrible scene of the blood and carnage which was among the people, both of the Nephites and of the Lamanites. And every heart was hardened so that they delighted in the shedding of blood continually. And there never had been so great wickedness among all the children of Lehi, nor even among all the house of Israel, according to the words of the Lord, as was among this people." So, the most wicked that the children of Israel or the children of Lehi had ever been was, in the, at least according to Mormon, was during this period when they just were, you know, fighting all the time. And Mormon was really critical of the fact that his brothers and sisters among the Nephites had sworn to go up to battle against their enemies and would cut them off from the face of the land. So they kind of made this oath that they were just basically going to destroy their enemies. And strangely enough, over the last few years, you know, a lot of people have been making some pretty similar comments. And kind of the most famous of those people is Dick Cheney. For example, here's a quote from Dick Cheney. This is back in 2002. He said, "The war against terror won't end in a treaty or negotiations with the terrorists, but will end only in their complete and utter destruction." Sounds like something right out of the, you know, the Book of Mormon. There, it will end in their complete and utter destruction. So Dick Cheney's making a similar oath that the Nephites, you know, had made all those hundreds of years ago that Mormon was so upset about. So, again, but for whatever reason, no, it's a political issue. So we're not going to talk about it in church. If Russell M. Nelson gives a talk about war in General Conference, well, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with the Iraq War that's going on, just to steal some things that Josh was saying earlier. And so, you know, that seems really strange to me. And I think instead of thinking in terms of political or moral issues, we should just think in terms of gospel issues. Is war a gospel issue? Yeah, it's all over. There's all kinds of guidance in the scriptures about war. Is economics a gospel issue? Yeah, the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, there's all kinds of guidance in there about how what we should use our money for, what kind of economic relations we should have. And you know, so I guess I would just, again, probably the people here in this room, you know, we're preaching to the choir, but I would encourage us all to get away from either political or moral issues and just see it as a gospel issue and understand that, you know, as Joseph Smith said, there's really no distinction between temporal and spiritual. You know, it's all the same, and it's all things that we should be thinking about. The first time I really started thinking about this is when I was doing a study abroad in the West Bank in Palestine. I was studying Arabic at BYU, and I just remembering that, you know, on my mission in Germany, that was the best way to learn German, was to go to Germany, and I picked it up pretty quick, even though I had learned it in high school and hated it and didn't learn anything. Once I got to Germany, I enjoyed it, and I learned it really quick, etc. So I thought, well, I'll try to go to the Middle East and do a study abroad so I can learn Arabic. And I came across this program at a university called Bir Zeit University, which is a Palestinian university just maybe about 15, 20 miles from Jerusalem. And again, it's in the occupied West Bank. And I remember kind of reading some things on their website. It was talking about come see the occupation, you know, firsthand and things like this. And I started reading a little bit more about what the Israeli army was doing in the occupied territories. And I thought, well, if these are Palestinian towns and villages, what in the world is the Israeli army doing there? And, you know, kind of read more about some of the different atrocities that the Israeli army commits against Palestinians. And so I thought, well, this is where I should, this is where I want to go to school, you know, just for a semester and kind of see what's really going on there. And while I was there, I ended up meeting a fellow named Brian Avery, who was an activist with a group called the International Solidarity Movement. And that was a group of pacifists. They weren't religious for the most part, but they were pacifists, people from the UK, Canada, and the United States for the most part, who would come to the occupied territories in Palestine and just through nonviolent means try to protect Palestinians from violence that the Israeli army was, you know, engaging against Palestinians. And so, for example, if there are Palestinians that are being detained at a checkpoint for no reason, where there's a lot of violence there, the Israeli army would oftentimes beat up Palestinians at these checkpoints, and or if the Israeli army was going to come and bulldoze a Palestinian home, these activists would just try to get in the way and try to convince the Israeli soldiers not to do it. And just by having Westerners there, it would discourage the Israelis from doing really nasty things because they know that, you know, someone else is watching. And it turns out Brian was walking down the street one day with some other Westerners in a town called Jenin in the northern West Bank. And an Israeli APC, or like kind of tank with an open top, you know, came driving by. And I don't really know why, but the Israeli soldier who was manning the big gun on the top, he just opened fire and he shot this guy, Brian. And I had spent a weekend with Brian, you know, before that. So I didn't know him really well, but just a little bit. But it turns out the bullet hit, you know, came in his mouth from this side and left his jaw on the other side. And so luckily it didn't kill him, but it just totally mangled his face. And so they ended up having to take him to an Israeli military hospital because that was the only place where, you know, the Palestinian hospitals just weren't capable of dealing with an injury like that. And they put Brian in, you know, again, a hospital room where there were these other injured Israeli soldiers in the very same room. And so I remember when we went to see him in the hospital, I remember kind of noticing him like, man, Israeli soldiers just shot this my friend Brian, and now he's in the same room as other Israeli soldiers who are really his enemies. And I thought to myself, man, if I was in that situation, well, how would I respond? And, you know, I just had this feeling like, you know, as a Christian, I guess I'll say I felt the Spirit, that, you know, we really shouldn't hate people. We shouldn't use violence against them. And I can certainly understand that, you know, if someone's going to come break into your house and kill your wife and do all these things, that, yeah, you know, there's times when violence is justified. But, you know, as a Christian and as a Latter-day Saint, that really is a big part of our mission, is to not go to war, not use violence, unless it is absolutely, absolutely, absolutely necessary for self-defense. And even better than that would be, you know, for us to all be pacifists. And so, growing up in the United States, you know, again, until I was, you know, I was 24 years old, I had never really thought about this stuff. You read the Sermon on the Mount and all these things, and, you know, it says love your enemies. But, you know, growing up in Salt Lake, going to soccer games and going to high school, I mean, when do you even really need to think about that? I mean, you just don't. And so I had never thought about it until I was really confronted with seeing violence there in the occupied territories on pretty much a daily basis. And then I was confronted with that a lot more, you know, when I was working in Iraq. But just, again, to reiterate, it is a moral issue. For example, in state conference a couple months ago, my state president got up and was giving a talk, and he's a really great guy. But he was talking about his son, and he made some comments about how his son is a bomber pilot in Iraq. And he was kind of saying, you know, we really hope he comes home safely, and you know, hope everything goes well for him. And I just thought, no one in that whole room of maybe 4,000 people thought to themselves, well, is that moral to be a bomber pilot in Iraq? What's he doing there? I mean, how is he killing people? If you think about the different airstrikes that take place in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, you know, like an American F-16 will come across, and whoever the pilot is, just gets the orders from some commander that there's this house that they need to drop a 500-pound bomb on, and they just do it. And obviously they kill people, they kill women, they kill children. And, for some reason, the question of whether that is the right thing to do, it just doesn't really, cross people's minds. But it is. You're killing people, you're killing women, you're killing children. You need to think about what you're doing. And again, in the Book of Mormon, there's a lot of guidance on whether doing those types of things is right or wrong. And there's a really nice poem by a fellow named Bertolt Brecht. He was a pretty famous communist from Germany who wrote a lot of anti-Hitler literature. And he basically, just kind of paraphrasing the poem, it sounds really nice in German. It's not going to sound so nice when I say it. But he basically said, as if he's talking to, say, the president of the leader or the people in the government and the military in Germany, he's like saying, your tanks are really fantastic. They can, destroy whole forests and shoot these huge rounds and all these different things. But he says, unleash a lot of violence. But he says, but there's one flaw. It needs a driver. And then he says the same thing about these airplanes. They can, go this fast and do all these different maneuvers, but there's one problem with them. They need a pilot. And then the final thing he says is that, the soldiers in the German military, they're the best trained and the most disciplined and so on and so forth. But he says, but there's just one problem. These soldiers can think. And so I guess that's what I just like to encourage people to do when I'm talking or writing. I write for a newspaper called The Mormon Worker. I don't know if others in this room have heard of that, as is Josh. But these are the type of things that we try to write about and make people think about and hopefully, over time, change the way that Latter-day Saints and Americans in general think about violence is to, instead of just blindly obeying whoever is in authority above you, think about what you're doing. Because at the end of the day, you have your agency, which means you're free to do what you want, but you're also going to be held accountable for your actions. And just because your commander told you to drop a bomb on a house and kill a bunch of kids, doesn't mean that you're not responsible for that act. And there are a number of soldiers who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan who I've not met personally, but just read comments that they've made where they said things like, you know what, even though everyone in my church and my parents and in my teachers at school, etc., told me that it's right to go to war and it's okay to kill in war and that I'm not going to be held responsible or I'm not guilty for what I've done, they say, I feel guilty. And there's one guy in particular who said, I don't think I can ever be forgiven for what I did in Afghanistan. For the different people he killed, et cetera. So I think as a church, we're really letting down, the youth who really need some guidance on this. They really need a warning that, hey, it's not right to go do this. You need to think about what you're doing. Think about the consequences of your actions. You don't just have this blank check to go kill anyone you want just because you're wearing, a uniform that says United States Military. And so that's what, obviously I wish that we as a church could do a much better job of, just like we warn kids about, getting, teenage pregnancy or about pornography or about drugs, if we could also warn them, about not going to war, that would be great. So, anyways, that's the end of mine.
Thanks, Will. Josh Madsen is going to be talking next about torture. And Josh is an attorney in Alpine, Utah, and he writes about torture and other issues for the Mormon Worker that Will is talking about. And do you have some here, by the way?
Yeah, we do actually. So, okay.
So if you are interested in more.
Come up and we'll have to.
Okay, so here's Josh.
Should have printed this out. I'm just going to look off my screen. When I was thinking about how to even approach this issue, it seems an absurd question to ask, is torture a moral issue? I thought a lot about... Yeah, I know, exactly. I thought, how should I approach the issue of torture? I could obviously appeal to your emotions by telling you the stories of individuals such as Dilawar, who is a 22-year-old young man in Afghanistan who was picked up by the soldiers for something that he never did. It was found he was completely innocent. But at any rate, over a period of 2 to 3 days, he was tortured so aggressively and so brutally, this 5'2", 100-pound man, that he died. They did peroneal strikes, which is a strike to the side of the leg. There's a nerve there. Very painful. When they did an autopsy on him, they said that his leg looked like it had been pulpified, as if a bus had run over it. So I could tell you stories of that, or stories of why torture doesn't work. The story of Abu Zubaydah, who was one of the first individuals to have torture techniques practiced on him by the U.S. government. This is when, unfortunately, Mitchell and Jess and two LDS members who helped design these techniques as members of SERE, a group that traditionally trains U.S. soldiers to resist torture, they tried these techniques out on them, techniques that actually had been pioneered by a psychologist for the APA on dogs. And they decided, well, if it works on a dog, it'll work on a human. And so Zubaydah was tortured. Some of the statements he made were statements that were repeated by Colin Powell in front of the United Nations and led to the war in Iraq. So I could tell you about how it gives you bad intel. Zubaydah's intel was later proven to be completely false by the CIA. The FBI said that Zubaydah was actually partially mentally retarded. Nevertheless, we had to torture him to get whatever information we needed. Certainly, Zubaydah didn't lead to the war in Iraq. It seems like there's some more information coming out even as recently as this week from Ron Suskind that it's even more heinous than we thought before. But since I'm talking about torture, I'll stick to that. I could talk about torture and how it's incompatible with our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, how we believe that all individuals are entitled to life, liberty, and freedom, that the Bill of Rights, when you read them, they don't apply to U.S. citizens. They apply to all people. We could discuss what are we telling a nation when we say we want to give you a democratic government, but your rights really aren't God-given. They're rights that the government gives you, and so we can torture, we can kill, we can take them away from you. And what does that tell our own citizens? That if the government can do that to other people, what can they do to us? It surely makes the Bill of Rights a very shallow thing and something that's precarious. When you think of torture, the purpose of torture is to break a human being. When you think of the word break, it means you can't put it back together. What happens to these individuals when they're tortured? They are broken. It's not just a physical breaking. You break their soul. They break who they are. Padilla, who was one of the individuals that was tortured, for example, the nefarious shoe bomber, I believe, he was tortured so badly that when they actually held his trial, it was interesting, he became very defensive if anyone said anything negative about Bush. Bush was almost it's almost a Stockholm Syndrome sort of thing where he associated with his captors and torturers. He couldn't hold regular conversations with his own family members. He truly is a broken individual. But what I'd like to talk about when I talk about torture, since we're talking about it being a moral issue, less whether it works, I want to talk more about its compatibility with the gospel. Torture is the exact opposite of freedom. It is the ultimate Luciferian scheme of control and destruction of free will. This is the entire purpose of torture, is to get someone to do something they do not want to do. It's the ultimate form of compulsion. As LDS, we have this idea that free will is one of the greatest gifts or one of the greatest things that we have. So much so that God apparently allows rape to occur in this world, child abuse, genocide, all sorts of atrocities, rather than rob us of our I am, our free will. And yet we are willing to do something that God wouldn't even do through torture. We're willing to rob a human being of their I am, my will, their ability to resist. When I think about torture in the gospel, I think we forget often that Jesus Christ was tortured. We always talk about Christ as the Savior, he atoned for us, and we talk about him dying on the cross, but we forget he was tortured and murdered by the government of his day. If we were to modernize the story of Christ, would we be surprised if rather than being whipped, he was waterboarded? Or perhaps we could think of other devices they could have used on him. But certainly, those were the torture devices of his day that were used on him. And so when we think of torture, we're doing something that was done to the Savior. Surely he was innocent, but so are many of these people that we torture and kill. I think it's estimated that over half, if not more, of the people that in Iraq that are captured, the people in Afghanistan that are captured, and even the people in Guantanamo, the majority of them, they say, probably aren't linked to Al-Qaeda. This is coming from generals and official sources.
90%.
90%. There you go. 90%. That's a huge number of people that are being processed and sent through our torture regime. Most of them aren't waterboarded, that's true, but that's not the only form of torture. There's sleep deprivation, there's hypothermia, there's just the cruel manner they're treated. What are we telling these people? When I think about the gospel in Christ, we're told to love our enemies, do good unto those that hurt us, turn the other cheek. We're told this is how we become sons of God, doing what Christ did, being perfect in those things, loving our enemies. How we treat our enemies is probably one of the greatest indications of our level of discipleship and how much we've approached Jesus Christ. And so the question I think of when I think of torture is, what do we communicate to others about the love of God if we're willing to consider them an enemy? What do we communicate about the love of God if we torture them? What do we say about personal responsibility when we consider them an enemy, when it's only a hazard of birth that caused them to live under a different flag than me? What do I say about forgiveness if I punish them for the sins of their rulers? How is any of that reconcilable with the gospel, the good news? For the last word in the estimate of any man to be that, sorry, misquoting myself here. For the last word, what are we saying to these people when we do that? When we put them, put our own selves, our own lives, our own nation, whatever is above them, to a certain extent, I would say it's a form of idolatry. If I take the life of another, if I torture another, I'm saying I'm devoted to another value more than I am to the love of my neighbor. I'm devoted to a value more than the love of Jesus Christ, to which I sacrifice my neighbor. So I'm sacrificing my neighbor to an idol, whether it be my own nation, whether it be my own self-security, my protection, my philosophy. And so, to me, torture is a moral issue. Why I think it's so important that we make torture a moral issue, what happens if it's not a moral issue? If we don't speak out about these things, whether it comes from the church or individuals, members of the church, then we're left in a vacuum. And what happens in that vacuum is people adopt the morals of their society. So if I live in the United States, I'll probably adopt the morals of my government. That may be Republican values. A lot of members of the church, for example, find certain good things in the Republican Party. But because we don't speak out on certain moral issues, whether it be torture, war, or other things, we end up adopting the party platform on those other things. And that's why it needs to be spoken about. What would happen if the church had made a statement on torture and how evil it was? Would Mitchell and Jessen, for example, help to authorize the torture regime? Maybe they wouldn't have. I don't know. Would Elisa Peterson, one of the victims of torture, a returned missionary from Netherlands who joined the military thinking it was a great thing to do, goes to Iraq right after Donald Rumsfeld, quote-unquote, Gitmoizes the place. She's put there in the cage. She sees torture firsthand, and her conscience can't handle it. She ends up committing suicide. Would she have been in that situation? If someone had spoken about it, maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. I don't know, but at least she would have had that information, and she would have been able to make a more informed choice. So to me, the lack of speaking about it is very dangerous. Bybee, would he have written the memo he did if the church had been spoken out about this? In conclusion, I don't want to take up too much time because I know there's a lot more to talk about here. In conclusion, it's interesting to me that when I look at the gospel of Jesus Christ was tortured and crucified, and he died, an innocent victim. And it's interesting, he says that, I will send you the comforter. It's interesting, the word for comforter is parakletos in Greek. It means the defender of the accused, a defense attorney. I'm going to send you a defense attorney, which will show you how wrong you are about the world, about who's in the right and who's in the wrong. Satan is the accuser. The Holy Spirit is the defender of the victims, the defender of the accused. And so for us as Christians who have the Spirit, that Spirit is what compels us to defend the victims wherever we find them. And I think that's part of the reason why everyone on the panel is speaking about the things they are, whether it's about war, environment, money. We see victims. And so we're trying to speak out for those victims. In closing, I want to read a story that probably conveys my thoughts on this better than I can. This took place, there was a gentleman, Danner, who wrote a story about this. This took place in El Salvador in 1981. There were 767 people that were massacred. And the head of the officers at that time spoke to his officers. He said, "What we did yesterday and the day before, this is called war. This is what war is. War is hell. Now, I don't want to hear that afterward while you're out drinking. I don't want to hear you whining and complaining about how terrible it is. I don't want to hear that. Because what we did yesterday, what we've been doing, is war. This is what war is." And so, of course, we use war as sort of a code word to cover up moral things that we're doing wrong. If we label it with war, somehow it's moral now. One of my favorite theologians once said, if it's not justified self-defense, then all it is organized murder. But let me conclude with what happens with this story, and probably the part that struck me the most and really ties torture into the gospel. Before and during the massacre, the government soldiers had plundered the village and raped many of its women. There was one girl that the soldiers could not get out of their minds, a girl whom they had raped many times during the course of the afternoon. All during her torture, this girl, an evangelical Christian, had sung hymns. She had kept right on singing, even after they had done what had to be done. They shot her in the chest. She had lain there on La Cruz, with the blood flowing from her chest, and had kept on singing, a bit weaker than before, but still singing. And the soldiers, stupefied, had watched and pointed. Then they had grown tired and shot her again. And she sang still, and their wonder began to turn to fear, until finally they had unsheathed their machetes, hacked through her neck, and at last the singing had stopped. La Cruz was the name of a hill where the soldiers raped and murdered her. The name, of course, means the cross. On La Cruz, soldiers were raping the young girls. The young girl whose song would not die had lain there on La Cruz with blood flowing from her chest. The crucifixion of Christ was and is a ghastly thing. The question is, when will we stop it? When will we not do so by fleeing from the cross and its ghastliness, but by recognizing its universal meaning? So to me, Dilawar, Lisa Peterson, all these people, they're victims in the same way that Christ was a victim. And the question is, when are we going to stop it? When will it be a moral issue?
Thanks, Josh. Chris Nielsen will talk next about money and debt and capitalism. He's getting his master's at BYU in Spanish literature, and he's focusing on resistance music in Latin America.
Okay, I want to start with a quick quote from a talk, I believe a general conference talk by N. Eldon Tanner from 1979. He's talking about, personal finance and debt and counseling us, like so many of our leaders throughout the history of the church, to get out of debt and to avoid debt. But then I found these couple of sentences here interesting, and they sort of embody the question that I want to deal with in my talk. He says, "Our competitive free enterprise system produces unlimited goods and services to stimulate our desire to want more convenience and luxuries." And so he recognizes then sort of the artificial nature of those desires and how they are produced by or generated by this system. But then he says, "I do not criticize the system or the availability of these goods or services. I am only concerned about our people using sound judgment in their purchases." So my question then is, why are personal money matters and personal financial decisions considered moral issues in the church, while economic systems themselves are not, for the most part? Why do we criticize personal decisions, but not the systems that decide the terms of those decisions? We are taught correctly, I think, that financial decisions can greatly affect, for good or bad, the spiritual welfare of individuals and families. We are counseled again and again to pay tithing, to live within our means, to eliminate and avoid debt, and more generally, to seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness. On the other hand, economic systems are usually considered, if they are considered, to be amoral, to be neutral backgrounds against which individuals exercise personal agency. Of course, many church leaders vociferously condemned communism, an economic system, precisely on the grounds that it took away our agency, that it wasn't a neutral background. But capitalism is rarely, if ever, called into question because it has traditionally been seen as a mostly neutral system that fosters individual freedom and rewards hard work. But is it so neutral? I would argue, and Elder Tanner would seem to suggest, or at least recognize, that the free market itself, it's the free market itself that insists that we do exactly the opposite of what our leaders counsel us to do. Namely, live outside of our means, want more than we need, seek ever more gain, take on huge debts, and exalt the concept of financial security. And so are we really free in such a system? Or what about the fact, on the other hand, that globalized capitalism is contingent upon keeping billions of people in the third world in poverty so that they can serve as the primary production force for first world goods and services? Are these people really free? I suggest that in addition to personal financial decisions, we begin to criticize economic systems, especially capitalism, on moral grounds. And so I want to begin that discussion by offering a few specific criticisms of capitalism, why I think it's irreconcilable with Christian faith, including Mormonism, especially Mormonism. And so I want to focus primarily on the nature of money, since I agree with an English professor of religious studies named Philip Goodchild when he says that the critical feature of the modern world is, and modern capitalism included in that, is a society driven by money, banking, and credit. Even more so than the ownership of the means of production and whatnot. And capitalism, moreover, is concerned first and foremost with profit. Things are not produced for their own sake, but for the profit that they can potentially yield. And so my first point is that capitalism, if we want to talk about agency and how economic systems affect our agency or limit it or delimit the types of decisions that we are able to make, capitalism would stifle that type of agency in that it debases all desires and all all desires and subordinates them to the drive for profit. And so our decisions will eventually be decided by default by these, what one philosopher calls the automatisms of profit. And so in this sense, I don't think we're truly, or at least not authentically or radically, exercising our agency, but rather delegating our decisions to the impersonal forces of the free market. And so it is the market that's free, and not the human beings that that exist within it. Okay, and so on to the next subject, the subject of debt. I think our leaders are right to counsel us to flee from debt and to see debt as bondage, but we don't necessarily take that to its logical conclusions and apply it to the system, the wider system as a whole, a system that runs on debt and depends on debt. And so I think it's crucial first to understand how money is created. Money nowadays is created by fiat. In other words, out of nothing. It is no longer tied to a gold standard or directly correlated to material wealth, really, in any significant way. Rather, since the invention or the innovation of fractional reserve banking a few hundred years ago, money can be simply written into existence, through bookkeeping or nowadays through electronic means. That happens when somebody takes out a loan. The bank does not transfer actual money into your account, but rather simply writes that amount into existence and deposits it in your account. And they're only a fractional reserve means that they're allowed to write into existence a certain multiple of the actual money that they have on hand. So if they have, $1,000, 1,000 real hard dollars on hand, they can write into existence, say, 9 times that, and put it into people's accounts. And that newly created debt money becomes the foundation for future loans and future money. In short, the entire money system, or the entire modern supply of money, depends on debt. And so here's here's a problem, an inconsistency with the church's call to get out of debt. If everyone got out of debt, there'd be no more money. The money supply would cancel itself out, and the entire economic system would crash unless it were modified. And so you can't have your cake and eat it too. Either you support capitalism by staying in debt, or you get out of debt and fundamentally challenge capitalism. Furthermore, and more importantly, I think we need to make a connection between the personal financial decisions that we make and that the church focuses on, and I think, again, rightly so. But we need to make a connection between that and the systemic economic forces that we largely ignore. We cannot get out of debt on a personal level when the system itself relies on it. All of the businesses, organizations, governments we depend on for our livelihood themselves depend on ever-increasing debt to be able to acquire more capital, to be able to expand and grow. And furthermore, the system is predatory. Banks, financial investment houses, etc., seek out people to take on debt so that they can turn around, use those mortgages that they acquire, and sell them off and acquire more profit. And so, I mean, I'm sure you've all heard a lot about the mortgage crisis, right, that we're in, and how it's affecting our economy as a whole. The mortgage crisis is, to simplify it, is really an effect of usury. Usury was anciently prohibited by all of the major monotheistic religions. Usury being, again, in simplified terms, rich people taking advantage of poor people, offering them loans, offering them money on terms that they know they won't be able to live up to. And so thereby turning a quick profit on the loan itself by being able to turn around and use that as capital, but then also by acquiring the collateral when the person defaults and is not able to live up to the terms of the loan. So, I mean, that's usury, flat-out usury, which, you know, we had laws against up until 1980. And so that system allows the upper classes, allows the rich to take advantage of the poor, and allows that gap between them, the inequalities, to increase. And that's happening all around our country and all around the world now with globalized capitalism. I was listening to Bill Moyers a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about this and focusing on Cleveland as an example, as a case study. Cleveland has seen the flight of 90,000 people over the last few years. There are thousands upon thousands of homes that have been foreclosed and abandoned. The city itself is falling apart because of this situation. And so I don't think, and similar cases are, similar instances exist around the country, and so I don't think that is exactly a moral situation. This looking for a short-term profit over long-term sustainability, or on a more personal level, over the well-being of these people whose houses are lost, whose lives are ruined. All of these people in Cleveland, many of whom now have to live in homeless shelters. And so I don't think that it is at all consistent with the principles of stewardship that were taught in the church. And so I do think we should get out of debt, but this should not be just considered a matter of family or personal responsibility. The goal in getting out of debt should not be mere personal financial security, but collective well-being. We can only get rid of widespread inequality once we have challenged the system itself that creates those inequalities, or that at least permits those inequalities by permitting such things as predatory lending. Okay, so those are my first two points. And then the third point would be, after having touched on debt, talking a little bit about the moral significance of money itself. So let's recall Paul's words that we're all familiar with. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. And so I think we need to ask ourselves, why? Why is money the root of all evil, apparently? Or the love of money, rather. The love of money, according to the scripture and others, motivates mistake, error, sin. it causes us to err from the faith, to turn away from God, to turn towards money, to turn away from faith in God, to turn away from the atonement. Money divides our allegiances. We must either turn toward it or God. Recalling the scripture that you can yet serve either, you can either serve mammon or God, but not both. And so I think the problem with money is not so much that we often use it to buy luxurious things. It is the fact that it inspires bad faith. Unlike faith in God, which requires us to endure, well, unlike faith in God, it does not require us to endure uncertainty, ask ourselves hard questions, depend on others, or exercise hope in things beyond our control. Furthermore, Paul does not say that the love of things is the root of all evil, even though that can be, I think, a complicated matter, but the love of money. The love of money is a different sort than the love of things. Money is the means of acquiring things, but it is not really a material object in and of itself. We all realize, at least subconsciously, and I talked about this with the matter of how debt is, or how money is created out of debt, that money is not paper, bills, or metal coins. Most of us make essentially non-material monetary transactions every day with credit card purchases, online shopping, phone banking, online trading, and that sort of thing. What matters is not the nature of the monetary symbol. It could be bills, coins, feathers, or the dominant form today, electronic data. What matters is that the symbol work, that it have the power to get us the goods and services that we want. And as long as all parties involved in a transaction recognize the legitimacy and the power of the symbol, then it will work, and it will get us what we want. And that's why it's such a powerful thing, and why our faith is almost invariably and immediately rewarded, our faith in money. And money then, and I'm about done, money is essentially effective demand. We all have demands, but only individuals with money are guaranteed the power to realize them. This is why it is more fundamental than material wealth itself, and why we are so ready to give it our allegiance. What we want more than what we want is the means of getting what we want. And money enables us not only to acquire particular goods and services, but also, and perhaps more importantly, it frees us from the demands of others. Our social responsibilities, our dependence on the precarious fluctuations of the natural world, money gives us security over and against these things. We don't have to depend on our neighbors when we are sick or naked, when we can just buy health care or more clothes. We don't have to pray for rain when, even during a drought, we can go buy food in the supermarket. Money allows us to subordinate the demands of all other people and places to our own demands. And it allows us to cut ourselves off from the real world of social and material exchanges, from the ecology of the physical world, which I believe is God's domain, the world that God created for us to live in and to work in and to depend on each other in. And so in this sense, money is quite literally artificial, and the financial security that it assures us cuts us off from this world that God created. Non-monetary material economics keeps us tied to the earth, to communities, to other people, and to God in an ecological sense. And we are required to remain interdependent. That is one reason that money draws us away from God. It allows us to declare our independence from Him. Faith in money almost invariably yields material results, whereas faith in God is more ethereal, and its results are more difficult to substantiate. When faced with an economic problem, most people will opt for the more assured results of money. And there are alternatives. We could have we can have economies not based in money, or at least not based in debt money. We could have barter economies. There are local economies across the world that are experimenting with non-debt-based money. So money, for example, that's based on work hours. If you have, and it's local money that can only be traded locally, local currency, and say, for example, one bill is equivalent to 1 hour of work, then you can trade those without the types of inflationary and speculative dangers of debt money on a free market. And so, in conclusion, I think we're right to analyze personal financial practices through the lens of morality, but I think we should take this to its logical conclusion.
if it's good to be free from debt at a personal level, then we should think about freeing ourselves from the system that depends on debt. If the love of money is the root of all evil, then we should direct our love elsewhere by taking money out of the equation. We should challenge economic systems that divert our faith from God. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. I don't know if I'll introduce myself. My name is Ashley. And I don't know, what about me? I am getting my master's in creative writing and English literature at Middlebury College. A lot of people obviously have stood up today and talked about things that they would consider to be moral issues that they want to have included in the moral discourse. But several of them have mentioned or at least implied the problem that many of the things that we regard as moral have been politicized. And also, inversely, many of the things that we might regard as immoral have been moralized within our church. And so the thing that I'm going to talk about today is dissent, which is really basically a meta-conversation about all these conversations that have already been had today. And is basically... because I see dissent as one way of trying to adjudicate between things we regard as moral and things we regard as political and argue for the inclusion of more things we regard as moral into our moral system. And I think it's one of the most powerful ways we can do that, and therefore I think it's necessary to give people the moral prerogative to dissent from the prevailing opinion, and particularly to protect the rights of minorities to be able to do so. And as I'll talk more about as I go on, I think it's more morally imperative to do so in religion than in almost any other system. And so I want to introduce this idea about, I'm going to be talking about different reasons that dissent is important and different ways in which it is discouraged and my responses to that. And to do that, I want to talk about two different preachers. One of the preachers is fictional and one of the preachers is real. And the first one is a preacher in a book called Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. I don't know if any of you have read that, but it should be required of you, I think. And this preacher is a preacher in a small town in the Midwest during World War I and World War II. But I think this story is referring to World War I. And he says that he writes the best sermon that he's ever written in his life, and it is about the immorality of war, and particularly it's about the fact that war is not an artificial system. Well, it is an artificial system that causes great damage, but that war is at its base something that damages human beings psychologically and physically and creates irreparable rifts between human beings. And so he speaks in that language, in the language of religion, of sacredness, and he writes his sermon, and then the day before he's supposed to give it, he burns it. And he says that he doesn't go back on saying it's the best sermon that he's written, but he says he couldn't bear to deliver it. It is World War I, because all the people, there are only a few people left in his congregation, because most of them have been killed by the war. And the people who are remaining are trying to protect themselves from the influenza, and so they come to church wearing scarves over their faces. And he says he couldn't bear to look out on that audience and say what he really felt, that he was a preacher who felt that he had fire in his bones, the spirit in his heart about what was wrong, but he couldn't bear to say it. And I think that that is the position of many people in our church about moral issues, that they consider to be grave and matters of sacredness and matters of the spirit, but who feel that they can't bear to speak those things in the form that is supposed to be designed to speak those things in. And the second preacher I want to talk about to introduce another aspect of the problem of dissent and the necessity of it will be probably more familiar to you and also more controversial. I want to talk about the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who, if you have lived in a non-televised cave for a long time, was Barack Obama's preacher in Chicago. And when the whole controversy came out about his speeches, I couldn't bear to look at it because I knew what I would feel, and it is what I ended up feeling. So I held off for a few months, and a couple weeks ago, I finally decided, okay, I'm going to see what all the fuss has been about with Jeremiah Wright. So I went on our friend YouTube, and I watched the speech that has been the most publicized and controversialized. And I don't know if you've seen that speech, but in it, Jeremiah Wright becomes very angry, and he criticizes the United States for being hypocritical and for wreaking the very sins on other people, crimes on other people that it most condemns when wrought upon itself. And he is very angry about what has happened, and he uses biblical language to condemn America, and he says the phrase, "God damn America." And I watched this speech, and you might damn me for this, but I felt such relief that I could hardly speak, because I felt that finally someone had been brave enough to apply the precepts of religion to the problem of nationalism, and to admit the hypocrisy of so-called Christian nations, and to not overlook that hypocrisy simply because the nation is an institution, and that usually by virtue of such gets a free pass morally. And I felt that he was finally someone who had not been beguiled by the artificiality of the political system into believing that politics was more important than people. Someone who did not create a hierarchy that always put institutions above humans or close neighbors above faraway neighbors. In all honesty, I felt intensely grateful to Reverend Wright, and I considered moving to Chicago to go to his services. I thought it would be a relief to sit in a church and hear a leader address the political plight of the poor and suffering rather than just the proximal plight of the poor and the suffering. And so I let myself feel that relief for a moment, and then I braved the comment section of the videos, and it was as depressing and horrifying as I thought it would be. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of comments from people who, first of all, were in a state of complete disbelief that these comments could even be made about their country, and secondly, that would endlessly repeat the goddamn section of the speech, decrying Wright as a lunatic and sometimes a rhetorical terrorist. The point of my speech is not to defend Reverend Wright, although I would do that if I had a speech for that purpose, but I wanted to talk about that as a case study of what is going on in the political and personal divide in America, why it is that we cannot apply the personal ethic that we expect from ourselves and other humans to the abstract sphere of politics and economics. And I want to talk about how dissent is a way of moving the conversation from merely being a personal conversation about morality to being a political conversation, and to criticize lovingly institutions that do not allow that continuum to occur naturally, but that try to divide it up and then divide our souls and our moral obligations to people all over the world. I think that we must dissent, whether it's religious or political dissent, or any other fill-in-the-blank kind of dissent that people might be talking about, because churches, as Jeremiah Wright's speech points out very compellingly, have too frequently aligned themselves with the national interests of the places they exist and with the powerful, when it is supposed to be religion's job to align itself with the weak and the suffering of all nations, beyond all artificial impositions of boundaries, class distinctions, etc. And I believe that another thing that Jeremiah Wright's speech highlights, and that I want to highlight by talking about dissent, is that suffering, as other people have said on this panel, is a personal and sacred issue that must be addressed personally and sacredly, but also politically, so that suffering will be alleviated or eradicated. And I saw this most tellingly in the 5 minutes after I finished watching that speech and watched another thing that popped up on YouTube when I watched the first speech. And it was a 7-minute clip of a pre-interrogation conversation at Guantanamo Bay between the interrogators and a prisoner. And I can't remember all the specifics, but the language that they were using toward that human being was disgraceful and it made me weep. And as I watched it, I realized for the millionth time, but more powerfully than maybe in a very long time, that this issue, the way this person was being treated and being spoken to, had nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans or any other party distinction had nothing to do with churches and their doctrines and the differences between their doctrines, but had to do with an individual human being who was suffering and had to do everything with me and anyone who was aware of it and our responsibility to stop that kind of suffering. The problem with this feeling is that I felt it and then I had nowhere to take it, mostly because in my own religion, for all the good that it does and all the things that I think it values and the sacredness that it upholds, it does not allow me to talk about these issues in church where they most need to be talked about and where they could be talked about in the language of the sacred, because they are regarded as a political issue, which brings up the problem that I talked about at the beginning all over again. Frequently, churches align themselves with certain national issues and certain powerful interests, and they politicize what are deeply moral issues and prevent the conversation about morality from entering the church. And dissent is one way of, like I said, negotiating that divide. The problem is that many people in the church are precluded or exempted from exercising, not exempted, excluded from exercising their right to dissent because of what are seen as the political ramifications or the faith ramifications of dissent. And I've seen this in many ways, and I've seen personal suffering as a result of this kind of silence. But I received a letter a couple days before this speech, and from a man who had read my blog and read something I had written in Sunstone, and he described to me how he, in the 70s, had felt that the Christian gospel that was in him required him to fight for the rights of blacks, the civil rights and the religious rights of blacks, and that soon after he had begun fighting for those things in the spirit of peace, he sat through a state conference in which his state president delivered a sermon about how he, the writer of the letter, was the Antichrist for what he was doing to fight for black rights. And I think the extremity of that is hopefully an isolated incident, but the response to that person is not an isolated incident, unfortunately. And I believe that too frequently, the moral causes that we take up in the principle, the soulful principle of Christianity, are regarded as dissident and wrong and dangerous because we have created a religion that is too flush with certain national interests to view its moral prerogative clearly. And I felt great sorrow for this person because I do not believe that he should have to suffer psychological or emotional trauma or loneliness because he is trying to stand up for the principle of fairness. But when I say these things, a lot of people give me a variety of responses. One is that I have to work inside the system. Another is that I cannot be angry, that I must stay positive. Another is that I should criticize myself more than other people. And another is that if I wait, then the world will work itself out. And I understand the spirit behind the things that are said, and I agree with a lot of them to a certain extent, but I believe that it is wrong when a religion uses personal virtues to obscure the conversation about structural or political problems. When it asks for my forgiveness to an individual who has harmed me or restricted my voice in my own religion, and creates a hierarchy of forgiveness that requires me to forgive that person more than I am required to ask for the fair treatment of somebody across the world who is suffering, I do not believe that that is correct. I also do not believe in the injunction against anger. I was reading one of Bill Moyer's books yesterday, and he has a chapter called A Time for Anger, and he talks about reading Matthew and reading about Jesus' forgiveness and his acts of personal forgiveness, and then later in the same chapter, reading about Jesus going to the temple and throwing over tables because the sacredness of the gospel he was preaching had been violated structurally, economically, politically, and in people's hearts. And I also have another book, one of my favorite books, Franny and Zoe, that talks about the same thing. Franny and Zoe are having a conversation, and Franny says she loves the Jesus who says that she is more important, sorry, Katie, than sparrows. But Zoe responds and he says, yeah, you always did have a hard time with the table-throwing Jesus. And I think that there is a table-throwing gospel in all of our hearts, and that that is frequently denied us because we have created a religion that is in many respects largely suburban, and by that I mean that we are insulated from what is wrong, from what would enrage us, and what would demand from us radical, empathic action, and we are told that it is responsible and spiritual of us to be polite. When maybe there are causes for anger, there are causes for Reverend Wright's anger, there are causes for our own individual anger, and that that anger might often, and sometimes at least, take precedence over our obligations to the proximal people around us. I think that is another thing that dissent does. It argues to expand indefinitely the circumference and the circle of the people to whom we owe a responsibility, and it fights for that in the face of bad arguments. And there are three other platitudes that I want to address in my argument for the sacred purpose and function of dissent. One is that I'm told to practice moderation. Two, like I said, that I can do more good inside the system than outside it. And three, that the gospel will solve the world's problems. And I would agree with this if I lived in a world that was moderate, a society that had moral structures, and a religion that addressed political problems. But our society is not moderate. Our society is, and I'm using this term literally and not as an epithet, insane in many of its actions. Our structures and institutions require that we treat everything, people, and I'm not talking about the LDS religion in this section, but people, the earth, and ideas with sociopathic disregard. Those structures and institutions further promote this behavior by convincing us that we are not responsible for our actions, and that we have the right to consider ourselves before our community. The fact is that we are material extremists arguing for moral moderation and not the other way around. And that is the triumph of what I would call, as a metaphor, suburbia, to convince us that our lives, expectations, and systems are normal, and that if we are implicated in them, it is a necessary part of pursuing the good life. The triumph of suburbanized religion, furthermore, is to convince us that the only crimes are the crimes of the body, that we must be absolutely untouched by hands and drink, even as we cover ourselves in the fingerprints of abstract tragedy. Suburbanized religion is also frequently too often a religion of red herrings, a sermon against sex and strong drink that clamors so loudly we can't hear ourselves sin. It is a religion that sacralizes often being implicated. I'm not against the word of wisdom or the law of chastity, but I am, however, against a cultural religion that has drawn a chalk circle around its dying body, a religion of the individual body that excludes the body politic. I'll probably never hear the end of that end of it for saying such a thing, and it isn't because I don't appreciate what my religion has offered me, but it is because I would like to have the freedom and to have everybody have the freedom to apply the principles of their personal morality on a political level in the spirit of Christianity and the spirit of love and soulful forgiveness. And I believe that the gospel cannot do that until we make a connection between our personal lives and our larger political lives. And by political, I don't mean a political party. I mean our actions that affect people that we cannot see. And until we make that connection, our efforts to talk about and change these things will be ad hoc and scattershot and will not be enough to stop the suffering that we are obligated to stop in the world. I believe that dissent is one way to have the conversation about how to apply our personal morality to the political realm and to make a connection between the personal wrongs that we might commit and the great public wrongs that we might commit. And I do not believe that by excluding the things that we have talked about today, we create a religion that is not political. I believe we create the most dangerous kind of political religion, which is not a religion of pacifism, but a religion of passivism, and that has created passivism as a religious virtue rather than as a liability on the human soul. And we have compartmentalized our religion dangerously so that we cannot apply the love that we need to apply to all souls. And I believe in that process, we frequently mythologize our history and magicalize our leaders while pragmatizing our present and demagicalizing ourselves. And I believe that is wrong. I believe that dissent is the right of a person to say that a church or an organization is not doing as much as it could. It is the privilege and the right of having a conversation about how to reconcile or adjudicate internal and external inconsistencies. And it is the conversation that expands our obligations to people. And I believe, in closing, that the psychological damages that come from not letting people speak what they see to be internal inconsistencies, or not letting them offer, in the spirit of religious communion, what they consider to be moral, is those psychological damages are real, and they affect people, they isolate people, they ostracize people, and they keep people from doing the good that they could in the world. And so I believe that we should create a religion that is structurally safe for minorities, that does not require minority opinion, whatever it may be, to suffer the brunt of the arguments that the majority party should suffer, and that allows people to reconcile in an open, honest way the problems that they see in the thing that they love the most. And I believe we should offer people this freedom in our own religion and in our society in general, and that until we do so, we will be responsible for suffering that we could have avoided. Thank you.
Excited to ask it. So, I admire all of you for taking like strong positions on issues you believe in, and I think you've demonstrated well that those positions, at least with the specific positions that you've advocated for, are compatible, like scripturally and doctrinally, with Mormonism, and beyond compatible, like very supportive. But unfortunately, there's like this reality that there's an incompatibility culturally and maybe on some other levels too with some of these positions and Mormonism. And so, and sometimes that can be like very uncomfortable and even painful. So, and I'm wondering what kind of a success or lack of success or failures you guys have personally encountered in holding these positions and espousing these positions among more mainstream members of the church, and if you just like keep quiet when you guys are sitting in Sunday school and whatever political issues come up, do you keep quiet? Do you speak up? Do you flip tables over? Like Ashley said, where's the place for anger? Obviously, these are like judgments you have to make, but it becomes difficult to maintain like a connection to the church. At times when I'm faced with some of these issues that I'm like just perplexed by. So that's my question.
Anybody can answer that. And also, if it goes over and you can leave, we don't think you're rude, so you can leave. But I'd like to answer that question as honestly as I can. That doesn't mean I answer other questions dishonestly, hopefully. But Mike.
Here's this one.
Oh, okay.
Alright.
This still work? Okay. In all honesty, the reason that I wanted to speak about the thing that I did was because I believe that there is almost nothing more psychologically damaging than being denied your voice in the institution that you love, and that I think creates a culture of that ostracizes people who are trying in some ways, most valiantly, to reproduce the spirit of the founder of our religion, Joseph Smith, or the founder of any beautiful idea. And in complete honesty, I didn't even want to come and talk about this today because I get emotionally downtrodden because I feel like the things that I say don't have a venue, or they have a venue, but it's with people who already usually agree, and that I don't know how to make the connection between the things I'm saying here and the things I would like to be able to say in church. And this is a personal answer, like I said, but I haven't been to church for a long time because I don't feel like I can say those things there. I feel like I tried for a very, very long time to articulate these things. And it's not that people were hostile, but there was no structural format in place for us to have an extended conversation that would require me to respect their ideas as much as I wanted them to respect mine, and to have a robust conversation about that. And so I feel like I practiced for a long time being the change I wanted to see in my religion, and in all honesty, it has left me feeling very, very disillusioned and sad.
I'll give him
I know that we're over time tonight, and so maybe I'll just phrase this as something next to consider, or something that, everybody on the panel spoke about. Well, the first four speakers spoke about specific issues that should be considered as moral issues in the church, or as rather than simply excluded political issues. And there was a little bit of meta conversation, but not that much specific conversation about why these particular issues are excluded as opposed to other issues. And I know that people were thinking about this, and there was some reference to kind of national interests, various things like that. And maybe the next step is to say, well, why are these issues considered moral and these issues considered political? And I'll just throw out my own personal sort of idea about that, which has to do with, I think maybe it's Armand Mas that talks about the sort of history of the church, where in the 1960s, there was he calls it a period of retrenchment, where sort of culturally and politically, the Mormon Church tended toward an affiliation with sort of conservative Christian culture and politics, and so it seems as though that interest, that dominant interest, conservative religious groups within the United States have been able to define what is moral and what is excluded from the moral discourse. But it seems as though structurally in the United States on the whole, that is changing. That is that a lot of Christian evangelicals are also questioning what issues are moral and which issues are political, and that on the whole, that period of conservative retrenchment seems to be in crisis in the United States. And I thought, is there hope or a possibility that with that broad-scale cultural and political change within the United States, there might be also a sort of concurrent cultural political change within the Mormon Church? So I don't know that we need to discuss that issue further, but just the question of, specifically in the United States context, why are these issues political? Why are they moral? I think there are very specific answers to those questions, or at least possible answers to those questions. So, anyway.
Did you have a comment on that?
Yeah,
if
anybody
had
a comment.
To answer your question, I think the reason why it's such an issue in the United States is because we're in the United States. In this regard, that environmentalism in the history of church is usually sort of a side issue. But as to economics, war, torture, and it's unfortunate it is, but it's sort of a side issue in the terms that it hasn't been addressed in the same way. There was a point in our history where you had the economic declaration by the First Presidency and all the Mormons as well, that it was a radical document. You read it, it sounds something social, something communist. You have very anti-war statements. But I think, like Armand Mas, if you point out what's happened, is we put our government first, our nationalism first. We allow our children to decide and pick their religion, but we don't allow them to pick their country. We're U.S. citizens first and foremost. And unfortunately, that's become the ideology and sort of the thought of many religions, and including our own. And that's why we adopt things such as war and some of these other issues, the economics. It's because we'll defend that tooth and nail, because that's what we're asked to sacrifice for. How often do people die for their religion? Not often, but we do die for our country. And when you die for something and sacrifice for something, it becomes more real and more profound than your religion. And so, unfortunately, I think that's why that happens in nations. Will it change? There is a spiritual awakening that seems to be going on. I'm hopeful, but you never know. I mean, you're battling with nationalism, something that runs deep in people. But hopefully there's voices that will eventually change that.
Well, just in short, I think the greatest immorality is a personal lack of personal integrity. And we all feel that great divorce about being in church and having personal feelings about justice in the world and not being able to translate that to anything, it seems, like in the church. You know? And that can be very frustrating. That's why I want to encourage everybody to become involved with the Mormon workers somehow, in whatever your level expertise or interest is, because I feel once you have a forum like the Mormon Worker, which is part of Mormonism, where you can express yourselves, learn with others, then you create a platform to go further, as little as that may seem to go sometimes, but that's where you start. So I really want to encourage everybody to become part of the Mormon Worker.
Well, I could go on without saying anything. I know these people for some time. By the way, Ashley Sanders wanted to organize the alternative commencement of BYU against Dick Cheney. So definitely there was dissent. A couple things, people in the audience. There are some publications, the MormonWorker.org. I have a website called Mormon Peace Project. There's another group called, it's really really cool, it's called the LDSCooperative.com. These are English saints from London who are forming a collective and talk about alternative economic orders. So even though we might be the minority, I think that it comes from the basics. Ash, as far as Sunday school and so on, a lot of times one can actually say, your brother and sister, if you want to talk more about these issues, let's get together in our little home, start a community discussion group, you know, and start discussing those issues more at length. Every time I go to Sunday school class, I make sure that when the people of Ammon refuse to kill their brother and gave their lives to that, because they were converted to Jesus Christ. That makes it really a gospel issue. How can you argue against something like that? And yet, why can we all become like the people of Ammon? Why can we all become to renounce war, proclaim peace, and Doctrine and Covenants, 98 section of Doctrine and Covenants? There is more and more thought about this. Meridian Magazine is a pretty neat magazine, and the whole issue of this professor was renounce war, proclaim peace. And we just got to keep on publicizing the Mormon Worker, Mormons Peace Project. There was actually Mormons for Johnson, Mormons for Peace and Justice in Holland, and the English Saints and so on. So I ask you people who want to sign up on this list here to keep on, get a down email list and so on, so you can keep on continuing this conversation. Please do so. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a couple of observations. I wanted to respond quickly to Josh's statements. The Bush administration bent over backwards to say they didn't torture and to stay within the law, at least when they weren't blatantly breaking the law in secret. They just redefined what torture and the reach of our territory was. They compartmentalized, as you mentioned earlier, they compartmentalized the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and our nation. You know, basically putting them in a territorial limbo. Their powers of rhetoric and repeating a lie and manipulative language would have made even George Goebbels blush and envious. We agree that there should be moral issues. The question is, why aren't they considered moral issues? And I think it's basically that we, as a church, have bought into the system. And we don't want to criticize the best system we've bought into. What I wonder about is this because our leaders have bought in and we're following our leaders? Or do our leaders know better, but they're powerless to question the majority of the members who have bought into it? And do they, in secret, you know, want to, you know, bring up these issues? I don't want to be too pessimistic about this. This will never become a major issue in the church. It won't happen. The majority of the church has never cared about these things and never will care about these things. I used to think, oh, well, if only I had good art. You know, the church will never have good art. It just won't. And it will never have really great literature. It just won't. It will always be a minority aspect. So, get present to that. Otherwise, you'll just live your whole life disappointed. This will never become a major magazine in the church. Neither will Sunstorm and Dialogue. Focus on making the small impact you can in the small way you can. And I'm not trying to say lower your expectations or, you know, or anything, but just realize you will go crazy thinking that you will make a major impact in the church. Focus on the small impact you can locally and in the small circle of people you can, and try and expand that as much as possible. Don't give up, but it just, you know, if I believed for a minute that the church would actually care as a whole about war, and as much as I want to believe that and hope for it, it's just not going to happen. But I am doing everything I can to influence the people I talk to, the people at Sunday school in very small ways, and I tell people about the Mormon Worker, and I don't know, maybe I'm just being inconsistent or a realistic dreamer or a self-delusional dreamer. I don't know what it is, but don't give up, but then just be realistic about it.
Well, just to respond to that, I mean, of course, you're right. Mormon Worker is never going to be a huge publication. There's never going to be more than a handful of people that read it. And so that's really the reason that we did try to start it, is just to influence more people around us. So as opposed to just having conversations with people about these issues, which I have all the time, you know, just to try and expand that circle of influence just a little bit larger, and just, you know, to provide something that people can at least know. Yeah, the larger church doesn't care about war. The larger church thinks it's okay to torture people. The larger church doesn't care about poor people. If they do, that, you know, if that's the case, well, fine. At least, you know, we can try and, you know, expand the circle of influence just a little bit, and at least provide other people who do feel this way, you know, give them the feeling that, hey, I'm not alone. I'm not the only Mormon who thinks this way, who thinks that way, etc. The other thing is, I've had a lot of success, I felt like, with this newspaper, you know, and also in just talking to other Mormons who are supportive of the war, who may support torture, etc. It's not because they're evil or mean people. It's just because they, you know, just haven't thought through the issues. They're constantly bombarded with U.S. government propaganda through CNN, Fox, the, you know, whatever, the New York Times, etc. And so they just, you know, they just don't have the information that they need to really make educated decisions on these things. And so I've been really heartened at how easy it is, as soon as I have a chance to talk to people and just give out some basic arguments why, say, the Iraq War doesn't, you know, isn't justified according to Mormon doctrine. And people who were avid supporters of it, after, you know, half an hour of talking to them, they're like, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. I can see why that's really wrong. Okay. And the other thing is, you know, having to do with the church leadership. You know, I don't really know if they secretly wish that they could speak out against the war, etc. I don't think they probably think that. And it is depressing that, you know, I believe your dad is Eugene England, and I remember reading an article that he wrote in an edition of Sunstone back in 1991 talking against the first Iraq War, and I thought, boy, we're not the first people to be saying this stuff. I mean, there have been people who have been saying this for decades and decades and decades, and yeah, nothing has changed. But at the same time, those general authorities, just like Josh said, they're also Americans. They grew up in a different time. They're really old guys, and people back then just had a different mentality, and it's just, they just see the world in a different way. They don't have a lot of the information that they need to make better political choices, and that's not really what they're focusing on doing. They're just trying to run the church. But I think that things will change, even if just because of the fact of demographics. I mean, you know, for a long time it was an American church, and even, you know, it was a church here on the Wasatch Front and in Idaho and et cetera. And so these ideas that come with just being American are, you know, really prevalent in the church. However, as the church grows, people in Latin America, people in Africa, people in Europe, they don't think this way. They don't think the way Americans think. They're against war. People in Latin America don't think that what the United States is doing in Iraq, for example, is okay. And so as the church grows, and as you have general authorities who come from Latin America, as you have general authorities who come from Africa, things are going to change. It's not going to happen as quick as I want. I'll maybe be dead before they change to the extent that I want them to change. But they will change because
you know, people in the rest of the world, Mormons in the rest of the world, don't think the way that Mormons in Salt Lake City think.
Yeah, all I can do is categorically disagree with that defeatism, that attitude of defeatism. Whether my efforts ever have a causal relationship, to me is irrelevant. I think they potentially may or could have that relationship. I mean, the matter of the MX missile project is a good example where citizens and members of the church directly influenced the attitudes of the leadership in the church. How often that, I mean, I don't know if we can expect that to happen on a regular basis, but it's possible, at least. That's one point. I think Will made another good point about the growth of the church in other countries and around the world, and the way that those sort of demographic realities affect opinion in church body as well as in the church leadership. And then two more things. One, again, whether my actions have any sort of causal effect on the leadership of the church is to me irrelevant, because to me, if I were to adopt that attitude of defeatism, I would be complicit. I would be individually responsible, at least partially responsible, for the types of problems that we're talking about. And I don't want that, if nothing else than for the symbolic absolution of taking a stance. And then lastly, I think that the types of economic crises that we're running into right now will have a huge effect on the way that we view the world, on the way that we view these types of issues. It will cause all of us, including leaders in the church, I think, to recapacitate, to step back, to reevaluate the stances that we've taken. At the moment that our economic system reaches its internal limits, as it is right now, we will have to question radically its foundations and all that goes along with it. You know, and I think that a lot of our moral decisions, a lot of our policy decisions, have not only been guided and influenced by American nationalism, but by the dominant economic system in America, by the free market. And so I think there is potential for another sea change. It's happened before in the church. One of the writers I referenced says in another part of his work that if the last 200 years of capitalism has taught us anything, it's the overwhelming power of capital to override political will. But once that power reaches its internal limits, once it collapses, once it implodes, as I think it's close to doing, then it will become possible to act decisively again. And I think we're near that point.
Yes. Can I just say that regardless of whatever happens, the outcome of your efforts or the fame of your paper, that I think you guys did a great job today, and it was inspiring, and I'm grateful for the fact that any people ever want to stand up and say something that is unpopular, but probably right. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you.
And I, Don?
You know, Emma Goldman said organize or die. And I don't think she meant that dying as the net result of failing to organize. I think she meant it as a command. Organize or get the heck out of my way. In other words, she didn't take no for an answer. I've been in the labor movement for 25 years. The labor movement is, for all intents and purposes, dead as a whole. But within the labor movement, there are pockets of activism that have done incredible things lately. The organization I work for, we brought Governor Schwarzenegger to his knees 2 years ago, defeated all seven of his propositions that he put on the ballot to try to defeat worker and individual rights. Things are definitely possible if you organize. Prescription for depression is action. You got to get out and you got to move and you got to organize. And this what you're doing here is an effort at organizing. Don't give up. And then as far as within the church, taught gospel doctrine for 4 years, and remain true to everything that I believe in, which is consistent with what's been said here today. And I never had any trouble because, you know, I always tried to do it with some sort of respect and loyalty for the gospel and for my own testimony, but at the same time, having that it's scary, but having the courage to say what needs to be said. And nobody ever challenged me in terms of my membership. I always had people come up to me and say, gee, I've never thought of it that way. Thanks for challenging me, helping me to think differently about the subject. So, you know, I'm very hopeful for that change can occur within these areas that we talked about. But it requires it requires action. You have to organize, and you can't, you know, get discouraged. It's tough sometimes, but I really think that it's possible if we do continue to move forward and organize. Because the history of the church has not always been the way that it's being described and that we talked about today. I mean, when you look at, you know, we say there's never been a majority of the church that's been against war. I would strongly disagree. If you look at the, there's never been a majority of the church that's been against, say, the existing economic order. I would strongly disagree. The experiments in communitarianism in this, when the saints first came here, I mean, are abundant. So I do think the pendulum swings and will swing back the way I think we want it to. But we've got to organize. First step in organizing is standing up and dissenting. I dissent. That's what it takes.
I want to say one more thing. I know that people need to go, but I think that Chris brought up a good point. I understand what you're saying. I personally feel very tired right now from expecting a lot out of people. I don't think that I will ever stop expecting a lot of people, but I agree that the emotional consequences are severe. But I believe that one thing that separates religion from other modes of action is that the value of the action is in the action itself and not necessarily, which is partly what you were saying, not necessarily the actions it's producing, although it is faithful and intent on producing certain actions and certain realities in the world. And second, I would say that it is wrong for religion to teach the spirit of communion, in other words, the spirit of when you have found the truth, strengthen your neighbor, and to ever deny that privilege from anybody who believes that they have found a truth. And I believe that the most damaging aspect of quashing dissent is that you tell somebody that they can have their opinion in isolation, but that sharing it would be criminal. And whereas I think that sharing is done in the spirit of religious communion, that is the truly powerful thing behind every change that occurs on a larger scale. And lastly, I think, to try to answer your question, I believe that the reasons that issues aren't counted as moral is because, I said this when I was talking, but we have fixated on issues or moral issues of the individual body rather than the body of the church or the body of the world or the body of the earth, etc. And I think that what dissent and education tries to do is to make the connection between individual bodies and the body politic, and that is its goal. And if we can make that connection in Sunday school, on a larger church level, in our conversations, then we can do more change than we think we can to move the morality that we're advocating outside of just an individual's body.
Let me ask you a question. What happened to you after Dick Cheney? You actually practically criticized Gorby Hinckley to bring Dick Cheney on BYU campus. What happened to your bishops, state presidents, or your friends in the church and so on in your ward? Can you tell what your consequences were?
Sure. Actually, I never was formally punished for doing what I did, which I think is good. I know that certain professors attended a meeting at BYU where they were told that expelling us would create a greater PR debacle than letting us do what we're doing, so just to be quiet about it. I had that verified, but I wasn't there, so I don't know if that's a fact, but I can see it being a fact having attended BYU. But the disheartening things for me were not actually the formal punishments, because there weren't any, but the unimaginative comments that I heard back from people who were responding to the event, and the unwillingness of people to go beyond the line of allegiance to criticize based in love, but also in principle, whether that criticism ended up falling on themselves or their church or their nation or whatever it was. I was deeply disappointed in that, and that had emotional consequences for me. I felt disheartened by that, and I felt disheartened by the constant cliched arguments I was given for why I should not act, and that I feel the similarity of the arguments against me convinced me that those arguments were symptomatic of something deeper in the church and the way we are taught in the church rather than scattershot comments from people who disagreed with me. And I also felt that people, I said this yesterday in my talk about the honor code, that they had not been prepared by their education to argue an actual issue outside of the bounds of fallacies and appeals to authority and tradition, and that really compromised a discussion that could have allowed a lot of people's perspectives in and been actually educational. So mainly, my answer is that mainly it was the responses that I heard from people, culminating in a woman in my ward who I'm sorry if I'm like picking on people, but a woman in my ward who I admire very, very, very much because she taught me almost everything I know about helping the poor. She's been involved with helping on poverty issues her entire life, etc. She's very inspiring. And I started a blog after Alternative Commencement. She came up and I invited her to read it, and she said, "I was really, really, really worried because you said the word activism in your blog. But then in the end, it was all okay because you said you believed in the church." And I just stared at her, and I had no idea what to say to her because I did not understand why activism would be an epithet. And I couldn't understand why that connection has been made cognitively and cemented cognitively in our church. And I think it is a sign of a weakening sense of expansive religion. So, thank you for coming, everyone.